Finding us in the famous phrase of his against, warning against the imminent housing of the eschaton, warning us against the perils of utopianism, reminding us that every society that sought a utopia ended up by a kind of procrustianism characterized by the awful, hideous work during this century of the great Nazi and communist totalitarians. These men were working against a sweeping of the intellectual field by the positivists, by the ethical behaviorists, and were reminding people of the full-bodied nature of modern American conservatism. And meanwhile, there was also, I think, and perhaps most important, some attention given to the case for freedom itself. Because the case for freedom, which is sometimes taken for granted, we see is extremely easily challenged. Is there a man more sophisticated in America than, let us say, James Reston? But James Reston goes to China in 1971, and he has his appendix out, and he goes to Tokyo, and he gives a press conference. And he said, I am a Scotch Calvinist, but nevertheless, I have always believed in the perfectibility of man, and I believe that in the society I have just visited, great strides in that direction have been taken. Some people, on hearing those words, suspected that when the Chinese doctors took out his appendix, they stuck something else back in. But it wasn't only James Reston who said that. In the ensuing months, in 2 or 3 years, journalists, professors, and poets flocked to China and came back singing the praises of Maoist society. Professor Ross Terrell, who wrote the two most celebrated pieces about Red China that have been published in our lifetime, pieces that were avidly read by the President of the United States and the journalists who went with him to China in 1972, didn't follow the technique that was followed by apologists for Hitler and Stalin during the 30s and 40s and 50s. Especially in Stalin's case, they simply denied all the crimes imputed to Stalin. They said it was dirty bourgeois capitalist propaganda. Many of them were saying it right up until Khrushchev himself admitted the crimes of Stalin. But Ross Terrell denies nothing. He doesn't deny that in China there is no freedom to join a labor union. He doesn't deny that there's no freedom in China to read a book that you want to read, or a magazine that you want to read, or listen to a radio station that you want to listen to, or a television station. He doesn't deny that there's no freedom to practice religion, no freedom to own property, no freedom to vote for anybody, no freedom to move from one province to another, no freedom to move from the city to the country, or from the country to the city, or outside of China. But having made all those admissions, he says, people ask me, is China free? And he answers, believe it or not, with great difficulty. Depends what you mean by freedom, he says. Freedom is always defined with reference to the limitations of the relevant entity. The relevant entity in the United States happens to be the individual, but there it happens to be the whole state. And he gives an example. He says, take the writer Kuomojo. In the 30s, Kuomojo used to write books that were read by 4, 5, or 8,000 people. These were people who wanted to read the books he wanted to write. Oh, but now Kuomojo is required by the state to write books that will appeal to 30, 40, or 50 million people. Quotes. Is that wrong? Says a Harvard professor. There's a trained scientist at Peking University whose inclination and training have been to the study of pure science. But he was required by the state to devote himself exclusively to pest control. Is that wrong, Professor Terrell says. And I think one apprehends, however dimly, what it is that has happened, that ideological egalitarianism that rushes in after practical diplomacy, such that Richard Nixon, who went to China to begin a dialogue with Mao Zedong, ended by comparing Mao Zedong's revolution with George Washington's revolution, ended by saying that we would have a long march together, as if Mao too were entitled to his Via Dolorosa. Why should we not ecumenically share our own with him? Where's Vatican III? And then coming back to Andrews Air Force Base and raising his hands and proclaiming the great enthusiasm the Chinese people feel for the government. No doubt the Chinese people, the Chinese government had developed highly refined techniques for stimulating a devotion to the government by the people, and Richard Nixon was professionally fascinated by them. But the fact of the matter is that we saw there how easy it suddenly became to praise in the most respected intellectual circles life in a society in which none of the freedoms enumerated in the Bill of Rights is respected. That society became a society concerning which there was huge enthusiasm. Professor Galbraith went over to China, wrote an entire book about it, came back and he made one criticism of China. They smoked too many cigarettes. It became clear, therefore, that it was the responsibility of conservatives to reaffirm the metaphysical case for human freedom. The case, the absolute case in behalf of human freedom, the case that says that man was born to be free, that man is not simply a chance concatenation of chemical gases useful to ideologues who want to shape the kind of utopianism that's expressed in a society in which no freedom is tolerated, in which one doesn't know whether the principal enemy of the year is going to be Madame Chiang Kai-shek or Ludwig van Beethoven. It became a responsibility for us to recognize what I call the retreat from Wilsonianism. We were beaten in Vietnam, and when we came back from Vietnam, we did more in our extremist ways than merely repudiate an explicit Wilsonianism. Wilson had said it was the role of America to bring democracy to all the corners of the world. We knew, really, by the time we went into Vietnam, that we couldn't do that. Senator Fulbright had properly refined that notion when he said, the United States has no proper quarrel with the domestic policies of any country in the world, however obnoxious they are, so long as that country does not try to export them. This was the distinction that we accepted in Vietnam, where an effort was being made to export policies that we knew to be obnoxious. But as we retreated from Vietnam and renounced even that modified Wilsonianism, we found ourselves really, we being the poets and intellectuals to whom I refer, refusing even to say that the ideals of Wilson should be defended. Wilson believed in human freedom. He believed in self-government. We seemed to be saying not only that we weren't going to send the Marines to bring democracy to any part of the world, we were saying also, what's more, what right do we have to say that our ways are better than their ways? What right have we to say that the liberties we are promised by the Constitution are better than the kind of life that is prescribed by Mao Zedong? Thus, that final expression of a grotesque relevance that robbed us even of that axiomatic belief in the necessity for human freedom a resurrection of the case for a metaphysical defense of human freedom, I judge to be a part of the continuing responsibility of conservatism. There are those like myself who believe that that case is ultimately based on a spiritual ground, on a conviction that one cannot do to man what God himself would not want done to man. But it is not necessary to accept a spiritual lineage in order to make the argument that man was born to be free. Where he is not free, it may be as a result of sad or grotesque historical circumstances. It may be the result of excesses of preceding generations or revolutionaries or whatever. But that paradigm towards which the phenomenology of the world is in continuing approximation does not change. That paradigm says that man should be free, and that the just society, the good society, may not be one in which man has achieved that freedom. We cannot insouciantly denounce all the governments of the world that don't have our style of democracy because they do not have the institutional background to enjoy it. But we can only approve of those governments that seek to advance freedom, however slowly, but with a gyroscope that points unfailingly to the proposition that man was born to be free. That, in summary, is the case for American conservatism.
Thank you, Mr. Buckley. We will now have a question and answers period. If you are not located near a microphone and you would like to ask Mr. Buckley a question, would you please speak loud enough for him to hear you? But if you are near a microphone, I would ask that you go to the microphone to address Mr. Buckley. Are there any questions?
Mr. Buckley, what you were just speaking of about the attack on human liberty and freedom by communism in this century, I think you mentioned in obliquely, or you hinted toward that effect, is still a problem today, as we have witnessed an Alexander Solzhenitsyn whose cry was almost strangled behind the Iron Curtain, as we have witnessed the annihilation and genocide that is taking place within Cambodia, as we have seen in through the works of intellectuals in France right now who argue that Marxism is really a barbarism with a human face, and the cries and concern of people in our own country, liberals as well as conservatives, Senator Moynihan, for instance, worrying about democracy dying out in this century. Given all these factors, why does it seem that totalitarianism cannot be checked despite all the warning symptoms and all these horrible things that have happened in this century?
You ask, of course, the single most important question of our time, and it is one that has tormented the most sensitive intellectuals of our time. It is one that Alexander Solzhenitsyn, of course, considers to be the great unanswerable question of our time. Why, knowing what we do, do we not accomplish that which it is within our power to accomplish? There are a number of reasons for it, the most basic of which are the imperfections of the human character. The human being who in tiny little transactions day after day acts collusively with the government in return for a piece of silver in such a way as to allow that government to diminish his freedom is contributing to an attrition of human freedom, which can elide into that serfdom that Hayek described when he wrote his famous philippic, The Road to Serfdom. When Abraham Lincoln, speaking to his biographer, John Hay, shortly after the Gettysburg Address, said, people thought that when I said, the question is whether government by the people, of the people, and for the people can long endure, they thought I was asking a rhetorical question. I wasn't. He said, my generation is only a single generation removed from the revolution in which we fought for freedom. It is an experience that I feel directly, having it's in my blood. But, said he, how abstract and remote it will be for our grandchildren and our grandchildren's our grandchildren. The question is it possible to arrest the attention of mankind sufficiently to cause it to appreciate the quality of freedom before it wakes up to find that by the processes of historical attrition, as has always happened in every free society in the history of the world, it's gone. An act of will is all that would be required, Solzhenitsyn believes, and I think that he is correct. In a strange sort of way, I think that we both overrate the power of the totalitarian countries and underrate their threat. If one were simply to provide the circuitry, which is the operation of the human will, if there were a dozen more Solzhenitsyns, the system would probably come shattering down. But it is not, we are not in a position to be optimistic about their generation when one sees how easily men as seasoned as James Reston are seduced by such complete totalitarianism as they praise as recently as 5 years ago.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Buckley, several times in the past, and most recently, I would say, a couple of weeks ago in your column, you advocated the incorporation of Israel as the first state in the United States. I wonder, with that background, if you comment on a proposal before Congress to incorporate the American Canal Zone of Panama into the 51st state.
Well, I should think that would be inappropriate because the people of Panama do not fear for their own security, and under the circumstances do not feel that there is sufficient cause to abandon their independence. What the Israelis don't...
Now among people or people outside?
I'm talking about Panamanians, not Americans. Americans are always going to be secure, as long as we're secure. Americans who live in the Panama Canal Zone are as secure as the people sitting in this room. The Israelis don't know from day to day whether they will exist next week. And they have so far failed to devise the architecture of any guarantee that's satisfactory to them, because they know perfectly well that we walk out on our guarantees. We didn't get Vietnam, and if absolutely necessary, we would do it to Israel. But we wouldn't do it to a state. Now, my suggestion is in a sense, an exercise in metaphysical ambiguity, because there is a sense in which an Israeli would consider that he had precisely lost his nationhood by accepting demotion to the 51st state of the United States. And therefore, in a sense, you walk into the paradox of the famous statement made during the Vietnam War about liberating a village by obliterating it. So there is that ambiguity, but it is also true that nobody has come up with a formula for guaranteeing Israeli security, and that the only way to guarantee it effectively would be to incorporate it. If we're going to have a foreign policy that acknowledges something very like the primacy of Israeli survival, and I myself support a policy that vigorously advocates the survival of Israel, the only way to affect it, if a defense treaty is insufficient, is incorporation.
Yes, sir.
What is your position in the Lockheed case before the Supreme Court?
I'm on Bakke's side, while at the same time resisting the effort to ideologize Bakke's position. I don't think you can ask an agent of the state to be an instrument of discrimination of any kind. However, I happen myself to believe in discrimination, privately exercised, judiciously exercised, in behalf of people who need help more than others. But it is, I think, a function of private rather than public institutions to make those gestures.
Yes.
I understand basically your conservative ideology, your definition of conservatism. What I don't understand is how your philosophy, if you want to call it that, incorporates or deals with basic, real, to use your word, problems in the everyday world, such as any social problem.
Well, my response to that is that nothing is plainer to me than that I should be asking you that question rather than vice versa. Peter Drucker wrote 2 years ago that experience has proved that there's only two things that the state can do. One is to fight wars and the other is to inflate the currency. We're not even sure they can fight wars, as a matter of fact, since that book was written. But I find very few social problems that have been improved as the result of government mediation. On this subject, Milton Friedman is, I think, supremely persuasive. Almost everything that the federal government has set out to do has not achieved the result that it set out to achieve. For instance, we now spend twice as much money, exactly twice as much money, as we did 6 years ago on medicine. Is there better medicine? No. Are there more doctors? No. Are there more nurses? No. Are there more hospital beds? No. It just costs her up 100%, that's all. And there is a corollary between the interposition of government and the rise of that. What kind of serenity are people on Social Security going to have in the light of current projections? We see a situation in which it required, at the outset of the program, two people less than 65 years old to support one person over 65 years old. Now it's four people. By 1981, it's going to be six people. A very good question to ask is, what kind of serenity are people going to have between the ages of 20 and 65 in the light of the load that they are expected to carry in Social Security? Has it really helped us to breed more highly educated people to spend in New York City three times as much per education of a child as in Lincoln, Nebraska? The statistics tell us that, in fact, it hasn't. By and large, it seems to me that conservatives don't say that all problems are soluble, but we do engage the presumption, remember my favorite word, the presumption that private efforts tend to be more successful than federal efforts. It costs in San Francisco 40% of what it costs in New York City to remove a ton of garbage. What's the difference between their system? Nothing as regards cost of living. As a matter of fact, it's 1% more expensive in San Francisco than New York. There's only one difference. It's done privately by competition in New York. It's done by a municipal agency in San Francisco and by a municipal agency in New York City. Those examples are abound. And I think that I think when one considers the fact that whatever our shortcomings, we are the wealthiest, freest country in the world, this is a wealth and freedom that the private sector has accomplished. For you to say that the conservatives don't confront reality is the equivalent of saying that this whole doesn't exist.
To use Jimmy Carter's word, a sympathy or a compassion on a very real level.
The humanitarian rhetoric lends itself much more easily to a Hubert Humphrey type than to a Milton Friedman type. But it's the Milton Friedman type that gives society the kind of advice that results in the creation of hospital beds, that results in more doctors and more nurses and better medical care and more residue. It was the governor of this state who turned in a sheer exasperation last April to the union leaders who approached him and said, "Don't you understand? Unless there is a surplus, there is no way we can help people who need help. And there's not going to be a surplus at the rate at which people are leaving New York State because we're making it impossible for the private sector to operate. Unless you have a private sector that's vigorous, that creates a surplus, you can't help anybody. Because in order to help people who need help, you've got to have that surplus. In order to have that surplus, you've got to have a kind of economic freedom and mobility, which conservatives continue to stress. I think Peter Banfield, in his book, The Unheavenly City, puts it well when he says, by and large, the difference between a conservative and a liberal is that the conservative is thinking of strategic solutions and the liberal is thinking of tactical solutions. John F. Kennedy went down and fought that West Virginia primary, the critical one. And he was photographed next to a man who was 44 years old, who during the past 25 years had mined coal for 255 days cumulatively. The rest of the time he was unemployed. So Kennedy promised that if he was elected president, he would shoot some money down in order to, in effect, guarantee that he could continue to not mine coal for a living. The strategic objective of a conservative would be to persuade him to go towards a profession in which he would be better utilized economically. And yet it sounds much more compassionate to take the position that Kennedy did than to take the position than, say, Milton Friedman would.
Okay, we have time for a couple more questions. This young lady here. Can you kind of stand up? Thank you.
It seems to me that one of the main problems in the country today is urban poverty and the problems that go along with that. How does a conservative deal with a problem such as that?
I'm glad you asked me that question because I wrote a book on the subject. urban poverty is the result of an economic imbalance that is brought on by political decisions. If we decide that by God, New York City is going to be 7 million people big, irrespective of a tendency by people in New York City to move elsewhere, then we're going to start using inducements that put such a load on New York City as in fact to accelerate the flight from it, causing a wider and wider and wider disparity between the cost of services that you seek to provide and the money that is available to provide them. It is, I think, for that reason that sophisticated men like Roger Starr, who must know more about urban problems and urban poverty than certainly than anyone I know, and whose background, by the way, is one of impeccable liberalism. He even writes now on the editorial staff of the New York Times, believes that parts of New York City should be abandoned. Should be literally abandoned, a complete suspension of services. The South Bronx, for example, which looks in any case the way Dresden must have looked on the 21st of March, 1944. But that the only way to save New York City is to cut down on the overhead involved in keeping it afloat, and that the best way to do that is to permit a natural gravitation of economic forces which are prevented from their own healing processes by these synthetic interruptions of politics.
Let's take one from this side. The young lady in the back, and that would be the last one. You? Why did you want to be mayor of New York City?
Well, I really didn't want to be mayor in the sense that I entertained the thought. It's like saying, would I want to be the greatest pianist in the world? The answer is, it never occurred to me. If I had become mayor of New York in 1965, New York's problems would have been substantially over. Not because of what I would have proceeded to do, but because anything I would have had to do would have been simply an act of supererogation. The fact of the voters, with my platform having voted me in, suggested that they ratified all of the reforms that were necessary to the constituted an advanced therapy for the problems of New York. Remember, when I ran for New York, the preceding highest vote that had been achieved by the Conservative Party was 0.5%. So that when I ran for mayor, I was doing, as I described it at the time, my jury duty. You can't found a party and then refuse to run or field candidates. So I ran mostly as a pedagogical enterprise. I continued to do all my other work, edit my magazine, write my columns, do my television, and so on and so forth. Now, at that, I got 13% of the vote, which suggests the merchandisability of the conservative faith on a wider scale than had been supposed. At that, I feel that I came dangerously close to winning. And as I said on another occasion, if I were ever to run again, in order to guard against the danger of winning, my campaign slogan would be voting by invitation only.
Mr. Buckley?